I'd like to remind all participants today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Gisela, for those who may benefit from this, would you please just list who's on the call very quickly?
With pleasure. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. On today's call on Monday, the 15th of November, we have Chuck Gomes, Cheryl Langdon Orr, Danny Younger, Sébastien Bachelet, Elaine Pries, Konstantinos Komaitis, Frank March, Steve Pinkos, Avery Doria, Robin Gross, Stuart Lawley, Liang Wong, Krista Papak, Stefano Trumpi, Mark Carvel, John Nevitt, Heather Dryden, Carol Dorgan, Richard Tyndall. From staff, we have Margie Milam, Liz Gaster, David Olive, Marika Konings, Kurt Pritz, Heidi Ulrich, Jamie Headland, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. If I could also please remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes, especially with such a large group. Thank you. Over to you, Chuck.
Thank you very much, Gisela. I appreciate that. Welcome to everyone to this call. And it's good to get together with all of you again. We spent a lot of meetings together there in a very short period of time. So welcome back. And hopefully everyone has had a chance to take a look at least parts of the guidebook related to the recommendations of the Community Working Group on Recommendation 6. If you have not logged in to the Adobe Connect room, I certainly encourage you to do that. It makes it a lot easier to manage the queue. But if there's anyone who is unable to do that, please let me know so that I can recognize that and then speak up, please, if you want to get in the queue. All right. Thanks, Margie, for sending around a little agenda. The first thing on there, really, other than the administrative matters that I just covered, is to allow the co-chairs to make some introductory comments, and then we'll turn it over to Kurt, and we'll start with Cheryl, and then Heather, and then I'll make just a couple remarks.
Come on in.
Okay, thank you. Cheryl Langdon Orr here for the transcript, and for those of you who have their lines open, it's star 6 to mute and star 6 to unmute for this call. Very, very briefly, I wanted to note for the record that the privilege of working with the cross-community work group on Recommendation 6 for the new GTLDs has been one of the high points in the time I've spent with ICANN, and that's not just within the wonderful world of at-large and the ALAC. It has been one of the most productive, proactive, frank and fearless conversations with, I think, perhaps the best example of a most successful bottom-up, consistently well-debated and yet still moving forward a piece of work. And it's a pity that it was done in such short time, but I believe we should be very proud of what was done. And I'm certainly looking forward to the opportunity to explore some next steps today. And indeed, I'm sure, a lot more work right through the Cartagena meeting. Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you, Cheryl. Let me turn it over to Heather.
Thank you, Chuck. I'll allow Frank March to pipe in if he wishes to, because really Frank was leading these efforts from the GAC side. But just one observation from me is that I had expressed openness to holding this call and having a session in Cartagena because I think it's important for the community, for the working group, to maybe have a better sense of what's happening on the board side and the treatment of the report that the working group came out with. I know there were some questions, and so this I see as a really good chance to clarify some of those understandings and allow us another opportunity when we're face-to-face in Cartagena. So that was really the benefit that I saw. Frank, did you want to add anything as an introductory remark?
Thanks, Heather. No, I'd just like to echo what Cheryl was saying. So I thought it was an incredibly productive working group. Very, very excellent model for trying to pull together complicated outcomes in a short time, and great deal of credit to Chuck for the way that he shared that throughout. But no, I simply share the same comments as Heather. I'm looking forward to having face-to-face discussions in Colombia.
Thank you very much, Frank, and thanks, Heather. And I also want to compliment everybody that participated in this working group, because it really was a great group of people, and all the participants are what made it a success. So thank you for that, and good work. What I would like to do is to suggest, Kurt, that because we've only got this scheduled for an hour, that I think it would be most productive if we could focus on the recommendations that were not included in the guidebook, or maybe were only partially included, and then, you know, give you a chance to explain to the working group why, what was the source of that decision and so forth, and possibly have a little bit of discussion in case, which was my understanding that you really wanted to make sure that we're communicating between the working group and staff in terms of what the recommendation meant. Is that okay with you, Kurt?
Yes, Chuck. Thanks very much.
And Margie, is it possible to put the recommendations up on the Adobe Connect screen? Marika's probably doing that. Are you doing it, Marika?
Chuck, do you mean the recommendations or the schedule with the staff responses to each of the recommendations that were included?
Actually, either one would be fine. I just want us all to be on the same page when we're looking at those. The schedule with the staff responses is fine, if that's easier.
Yeah, this is Kurt. I think the first table in the paper we provided might be the best because it's the most condensed version, and then we can go back into the other documents if we need to.
Thanks. That sounds good to me. So.
Chuck, it's Margie. If you scroll through the document that's on the screen, you have as Appendix A the recommendations and the ICANN response and rationale.
Okay.
Okay,
very good. So there we go. So I'm there. Hopefully others are there as well. You have the control of the scrolling on your screen. So let's turn it over to Kurt.
So thank you very much, everybody, for getting on the call. I'm somewhat daunted by the number of people on the call and whom they represent. So I'm not standing here, but I'm sitting here. I'm thankful that everybody's finding time for this. To the extent staff hasn't said it yet, and I think they have, we too acknowledge the hard work on going through a bunch of issues here that are really complex and trying to distill it down to provide, you know, this implementation advice for the new GTLD process. And, where I think we are now is that, to echo what's been said before, is, you know, we've had, we received the report and have had an exchange of documents, and now we're to where Heather mentioned, and that is that, more of a discussion rather than exchange of documents will get us to finding out all our possible areas of agreement and implementing as much of the recommendations as possible, or understanding the spirit of the recommendation and satisfying that intention in some way is most economically achieved through a discussion. So sometimes discussions are harder, but thanks for your participation. I think this is the right way to go about this. So what we undertook as staff was that we received the report from the working group, and you know, now along with you know, descriptions and explanations furnished by Margie and other staff who attended the calls. Different staff were on different calls. Margie was on them all, though. And then looked at the extensive report, and we're trying to figure out how to put it in shape for the board. So we got the we actually sent the report to outside counsel to distill it down to a table. So we got the 50-some-odd page report down to 21 pages. Decided that was still too long, so then we undertook the 6-page summary in this first table that takes the all the issues and distills them down into the 6 major areas. So that's so we took essentially this the 14 issues that were developed by the working group and put them in these 6 areas. So we, you know, we think for ease of discussion, this is the best way to consider them, but. It was a complex organizational problem, and I'm sure there's ways to improve upon how to distill these issues down and best describe them. So any before you even get to substance, you know, if along the way you have comments as to form, that would be terrific. And then so what we shared what we're sharing with this group in this paper is, you know, essentially the board paper that we. Presented for the October 28th meeting, which was a teleconference. Remember, the working group report was furnished the day before the meeting in Trondheim. So the discussion in Trondheim really went to going through the report and reading it, describing it, and then making recommendations. So I think I'm trying to think of any differences between this report in the board paper, and essentially there are none except, you know, the headings taken out. And there were some more documents that are, you know, background documents, previous letters and the like that were published as part of the paper. So with that, unless there's a preliminary question, my suggestion would be that we take each one of these issues. There's 6 of them, right? And is there 5 of them? I can't count to 5. And so we can spend, say, 15 minutes on each one. Chuck, just as a point of order, did we settle how long the call is?
I don't know that we did. I had thought it was for an hour, but I'm okay with an hour, you know, giving 15 minutes to each issue if there are no objections. Heather and Cheryl, you want to comment on that?
In my diary for 2 hours, I've got 120 minutes put aside.
Okay. Heather?
I have nothing to add, Chuck. I'm content to take the time we need to go through the recommendations.
Excellent. Yeah.
And just as a preview, you know, I'm sure everybody's read this, but I think, you know, the last issue is not as meaty or substantive as the first one. So, you know, if we spend more than 15, say we spend 20 minutes on the first few, I think that we'll still finish within the time frame.
Thank you, Kurt.
Sure. Okay. No, thank you. And so, you know, the first issue is a key one, and I'm sure one that, you know, we want to spend a lot of time on, and that's the role of the board. And in, so you'll read that in, you know, Trondheim, separate from this paper, the board undertook a discussion on what its role would be in the new GTLD process. There's been a lot of discussion about what the role of the board should be, given the ability to scale up, to consider a lot of applications and the areas of expertise necessary to evaluate new GTLDs. And so so I'll just tell you some of the basis of why what's written here, but I think, you know, I hope it's kind of clear to you, but there's a few issues. The first one is board capacity, the board being able to, you know, having the capacity to deal with a number of the large number of TLD applications we expect. The second issue really goes to expertise, and You know, just as in the evaluation process, it's fairly well settled that we want independent evaluators evaluating the applications from a technical and operational and financial standpoint. Similarly, disputes should be decided by individuals that have expertise in deciding disputes, expertise in taking criteria, making them as objective as possible, measuring facts against them, and providing a determination or a decision as to whether the facts, how the facts match to the standards. So, expertise in dispute adjudication is not a small skill. It's honed over a career, and that's why, you know, some of us are advocates and some of us are jurists, and so we think that expertise does not reside in the board. And third, there's subject matter expertise, so that, you know, it's been the question's been answered many times. Why should the ICC make these decisions? And in fact, they're not. The ICC is good at finding panelists with correct expertise. In this case, as been said before, these would be people with some gravitas, retired justices from international tribunals, which is one of the reasons why these dispute resolutions are kind of expensive, and that have adjudicated international disputes before, and disputes having to do with usage of language. So we think, you know, the board, with all due respect to the board, who have a lot of skills in a lot of different areas, don't possess, you know, weren't retained with the idea that they had the requisite skills in this area. So that's why, you know, it's also, this was also developed during the GNSO's work, where one of the implementation guidelines had to do with establishing dispute resolution processes. And so my last statement is this idea of independent dispute resolution is really a cornerstone of the whole program and how to make decisions on these corner cases. And by cornerstone, I mean a key piece in how ICANN and the big ICANN, all of us, are managing a complex area and managing the risks associated with volume, capacity, and the right expertise to make these decisions.
Bert, this is Chuck. Do you want me to manage the queue, or do you want to do it directly?
Oh, I would love for the chair to manage the queue.
Okay. Well, I'm just one of the chairs, but Cheryl has her hand up.
Thank you, Chuck. Kurt, restricting my comments specifically to the work group issue number one, that is the board role, and just picking up on a couple of the things you just said, remembering that what we spent as the work group, and I need for the record to be very clear that I'm speaking here in my individual capacity as an APRALO rep and as an ALAC member, not representing the ALAC, and certainly not just speaking as an uninterested party, someone who has looked at this certainly back since 2007. So I also wanted to just make clear that my board experience is fairly extensive, having got director jobs in for-profit, not-for-profit, fortune country companies here in Australia, and done a lot of board training. I recognise how and why boards are selected and for what sort of expertise, but they're selected for responsibility. And whilst we recognise that they must, indeed should, and if they're doing their job properly, have to take all the appropriate independent and in-house advice they can get on these things. When it comes to objections being submitted to the board, and that was all we were discussing, we would have thought that we weren't looking at diluting any of the importance, independence, or validity of external counsel from wherever it comes. Dispute resolution, yes, is an absolute art form, and it would be as a result of a failed dispute resolution process that objection would be in continuation, I'd have thought. So can you help me understand the staff memo points just on those issues?
I you know, there was some noise on the line, and I didn't hear the very last sentence Cheryl said.
If the objection was to continue to be even considered to be a maintained objection, then the dispute resolution process has in fact not resolved. Your commercial dispute process with all the expertise you've summoned has not got a result if it's an objection still continuing to the board.
So I'm really sorry. I don't quite understand your point. So if there's an objection, then the independent evaluators make a decision, and then the board will, in every case, note the reports that are done around each application. So that each application goes through a process, there will be some objections, nobody knows how many, and they'll be decided. And then the board will see that, one, the process was followed, two, that, there's an independent agency kind of overseeing the process to see that the process was followed and report on that. So I guess what I don't understand is how the objection continues. I mean, the parties in the dispute could still differ. Every time I lose a dispute resolution process, I still think I'm right. But I don't know what you mean by continuing objection.
Move to Robin. She'll probably be more articulate than I clearly am.
Hey, Robin.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great. Yeah, so there was 3 points that I wanted to make on this section. And the first is that I'm concerned that the staff report that came out over the weekend significantly misrepresents the report that the working group did, particularly the proposals and recommendations that we came up with. For example, we see over and over again in the staff report that the board can't possibly manage all the applications and vote on all the applications, but that was not what we recommended. What we recommended was that the board only look at those objections that have been sustained. Those would be the TLDs that the board would look at, not each and every single new application that comes forward, but that's the way you guys presented our recommendation in the report. So there's a concern that you guys misrepresented what our recommendations actually were in order to create straw men that you could then knock down as being unworkable. So that's a serious complaint that I have that goes throughout all of these recommendations that came out over the weekend. So that's the first point. The second point is I'm concerned that there's a new policy goal, a new primary policy goal, which is risk mitigation strategy for ICANN. I don't remember us ever deciding that was going to be a policy goal, but it seems that now what's in the best interest for the Internet is irrelevant. The policy goal that rules is what's in the best interest for ICANN, the corporation, as decided by corporate officers. So, you know, this is a really big shock for a lot of us to hear that risk mitigation strategies, as in cheap insurance policies and trying to avoid litigation, are now the primary policy goal. Forget about all of the community interests that went into negotiating these texts. So that's the second point I wanted to make. And the third is I'm concerned about this clear attempt to fob off responsibility from the board to some outside, unaccountable third party to be making decisions. We are all in agreement that we want these independent experts to evaluate the legal standards. Don't try to say that the group doesn't want that, because that is what we wanted. What we wanted then was for those objections that have been sustained to have to go before the board. And clearly, here, this is just a fobbing off of that responsibility, trying to, again, avoid litigation, avoid responsibility, rather than take responsibility and take accountability. So these are my 3 main concerns. They go throughout all of these proposals that came out over the weekend, and you'll probably hear about them over and over again. Thank you. If you could explain how that happened, I'd appreciate it.
Thanks, Robin. It's back to you, Kirk.
So thanks for your comments. Just to take them in a line. I certainly understand what you're saying about capacity, and we understand that too. I think that, I don't know how many morality and public order objections there will be, and how many will be sustained. Maybe you can help me. But my understanding is that if objection is sustained, then the board would have to vote by 2/3 to approve the upholding of the objection. And so when this was discussed, this is essentially the board would undertake hearing that objection, all over again. In other words, it would take the same amount of deliberation in order to determine whether that objection should be sustained if it's a board vote on that issue, with the attendant, homework and study that needed to be done. So even in low numbers, given the capacity of the board, I would think, each objection would easily take a board meeting's worth of work to prepare and work toward. So that's one. And second, then it lifts the expertise out of the hands of the independent evaluators and into that of the board. And when we talk about risk, we're just talking about risk to ICANN's policy and process. It's not the director's risk or its insurance policy. It's whether we have a predictable, transparent process that the GNSO asked us to implement. And we see that injecting this uncertainty into it and the extra burdens is something that works against what the policy recommendations are. And we do see a risk, a higher risk of litigation, and so that's not I'm not the one being sued, right? We're trying to protect ICANN, the ICANN model, and the new GTLD process. It really has nothing to do with the staff. So it was really all about that having a process where the decision makers aren't trained as dispute resolution providers or trained in restrictions on words. Or have prior experience hearing cases with international participants leads to uncertainty for applicants and poses risk to the process for ICANN. We're just trying to launch a new GTLD process that works good and lasts a long time, and we see providing as much certainty into the process as that.
Can I respond real briefly?
Go ahead, Robin.
Page 21 of the staff memo under ICANN response and rationale, it says, the existing process does not provide for the board to consider and approve individual applications for new GTLDs, which there may be hundreds in the first round. Again, this is a straw man argument. This statement doesn't talk about objections which have been sustained. This is a statement that tries to imply that our recommendation was that every single application for a new GTLD is going to go to the board. So it's a different answer on paper than what we're getting now. But what we're getting on paper is apparently the official one, and it's a straw man. It's not the recommendation of the group.
So, Robin, this is Amy Stappas. If I might respond, Chuck?
Yes, go ahead, Amy.
Thanks. So, Robin, I just have a question because if you can point me to the recommendation where it says only the objections, because what I'm trying to understand is if the process would be when what you're saying is that people would file objections with the dispute resolution provider, And then if they are, if the objection is sustained, then it would go to the board. Is that what you're saying? I'm just a little confused, so I just want to get that clear.
That is what I'm saying, exactly. And,
okay,
you know, if
so
there's anyone that has a different understanding than me, please, you know, let me know. But that was my understanding.
Let me jump in there. This is Chuck. I'm looking at the report that we submitted.
Chuck, we're having a real hard time hearing you.
Okay. Is that better?
Not much.
A little bit.
Okay. Not sure what's going on. Got the volume up. All right. what I'm saying is in the report that we submitted, recommendation number 4.1 says the ultimate resolution of the admissibility of a TLD subject to a Rec 6 objection rests with the board alone and may not be delegated to a third party. Now, let me just ask, is there any I think we're all in agreement. That was a full consensus recommendation that the ultimate decision is with the board. But what we're talking about right now is, does that mean that every decision for a name going into the root has to be delegated to the board? So certainly that particular wording doesn't specifically say that it's just those that are that there for which there was an objection sustained. Does anybody in the working group do you recall language in our report? I know we talked about this and talked about the idea that Robin is talking about, but can somebody point to a place in the report where it actually we use the language that Robin is using?
The recommendation 4 and 5 both use specific reference to objections going to the board, as Cheryl's speaking. So 5, page 21, specifically where Robin was referring to the ICANN response and rationale indicating an argument that says the board couldn't possibly deal with hundreds of applications, that text is next to the workgroup recommendation that clearly states objections. So there's one example.
Okay, thank you, Cheryl. Anyone else have some language that might be helpful here in terms of getting mutual understanding?
4.2, Cheryl again, under its authority to obtain independent expertise, as stated in Article 11A of the ICANN bylaws, the board shall contract appropriate expertise resources capable of providing objective advice in regard to objections received through this process. I can continue reading the report, but
no. No, I mean is that helpful, Kurt? Amy?
Well, let me just clarify, because to me, Chuck, and Cheryl and Robin, that seems different. What Cheryl is pointing out, recognizing that the report says objections, I think Robin's point is different than what Cheryl you're clarifying, because Robin said that only objections that have been sustained would go to the board. The report itself, as I read it, means that every objection would go at first instance to the board. And then it would be up to the board to hire and contract with experts, not just when something is sustained.
Yeah, Amy, I see where you've read that way. I'd ask the rest of the working group to perhaps indicate with, ticks or crosses, but my memory of it was that our sustained language is how our conversation went. I think it's an issue of the compressed time and the inability for us to have had dialogue between the report going on and the report being analysed.
Yeah, and that could very well be the case. Olivier has had his hand up for quite a while. Let me go to Olivier.
Thank you, Chuck. I'm sorry if I'm going to take us back by a few minutes. I wanted to respond to some of Kurt's mentions of the argument that risk mitigation is one of the primary reasons why a number of you're talking about a number of decisions are taken. Ultimately, the responsibility for the new GTLD process lies with ICANN. I don't think it lies with any outside resolution provider whatsoever. So the argument of saying that an outside resolution provider would be used specifically to avoid lawsuits and litigation is, in my belief, a strawman argument, because ultimately it might be that not only the outside provider will be sued, but ICANN might be sued in the same way. That's one point I wanted to make. The other point was the fact that if you're going to give the control for a process, for a core ICANN process, to an iPod organization, you really open yourself to capture. And we know how all of ICANN is structured, and all ICANN processes are structured so as to avoid capture. And I see the giving the yes or no answer to an outside organization, which will be independent of ICANN, as being something dangerous. Thank you.
Thank you, Olivier. Kurt or Amy, do you want to respond to that? It's not required. I'm just giving you opportunity.
Yeah, I don't get the capture argument. Can you? I want to understand it.
Olivier?
For example, this is not as strong as an example, but UDRP is an ICANN consensus policy where we rely on people that understand intellectual property law to make determinations between two outside parties. That's a core policy implementation of ICANN.
I agree with you, Kurt. That's fine for smaller processes, UDRP for specific domains and so on. But we're dealing here with new GTLD. This is a major chunk of ICANN business. It's a major process.
Okay. We can come back to that if we need to. Margie has had her hand up for a while. Margie?
I just wanted to provide some information on your prior question as to whether there were other parts of the report that addressed this issue. And I just wanted to draw your attention to Section 5 of the report that talks about the threshold for board decisions to reject an application. We have 5.1 that says that there should be a higher threshold for the board to uphold an objection. 5.2 says that threshold should be two-thirds. 5.3 says that approval of a string should only require a simple majority of the board, regardless of the input from the experts. So I think this is where there's some of the, gray area as to whether our report talked about, all applications going to the board or just the ones that involved an objection.
Thank you, Margie. I think that's helpful to point out that they noticed there was not unanimous consensus on these things, but there was consensus or at least strong support for making the differentiation between upholding an objection versus just putting a string into the root. I appreciate that. Alan?
Yeah, Margie said part of what I was going to point to that. I think part of the issue is this was a very compressed process, and along the way there were many different opinions, ranging from the board should not have any involvement at all to the board must make every possible decision. And the tone of the discussion, certainly at the end, is exactly as Cheryl and Robin said, that the crucial thing of import to the people was that rejections should not be done on a delegated basis without the board ratifying it in some way. That was the very clear message, which may not have been represented as clearly in the report as it should have been, which I think goes back to the issue of things that are this complex cannot be necessarily represented well in a very short, concise report. That there has to be some level of conversation on the crucial issues. But certainly that was the intent, I believe, of the discussion at the end of the group's actions, that the critical issue was the rejection process. And there were people who said, essentially no application should ever be rejected unless the board takes action. And that was certainly the intent, even if it didn't get represented well. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Sebastian. Sebastian?
Yes.
Do you have your hand raised?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to say that my impression here is that we have a real process broken, because we are trying today to rebuild something that must have been done prior to the board meeting. It seems to be that it's very difficult when the community is making a lot of work, if staff take one position without any discussion with us as a community prior to give something to the board, it's a broken process. And we see that, I see that within the at-large arena, I see that now, I see that in other working group. And I think we will need to fix that, because it's too difficult. Thank you.
Thank you, Sebastian. And my understanding is one of the purposes of this meeting is to do exactly what we've been doing, and that is to see if there's a misunderstanding between what we said in the report and how staff interpreted it and so forth. And so I would just like to ask Kurt, is this clarification of the of this particular issue in terms of the board's role helpful? Does it give some more insight in terms of the intent of the working group in that regard?
Yes, so not quite. So let's talk about the goals of, you know, we all have the same goals. So let's talk about the goals of this recommendation for a bit. I think all of us want to launch a smooth running process that makes the right decisions. And the objection processes were among the hardest to implement. So By interjecting the board role, which we think, you know, there's difficulty in them having adequate time and they don't have the correct expertise. So, I don't want to take up that line of thinking. But what's the goal? What are we solving for? What are you solving for in this recommendation? And of course, I'd like to get to, you know, maybe we can get to a solution space if we understand. You know, it's not just that the board votes. You know, we're all trying for some higher purpose. We're all trying then who gets to decide and what the role is. You know, from our point of view, the board has the ultimate responsibility over the new GTLD process. And putting myself in board members' shoes, you know, I would want these decisions in the new GTLD process to be made consistently by those the best suited to make them. And then I would like to, you know, watch the process and say this process is running as we predicted, or, you know, this process is not running as we wanted, and we need to make adjustments. So in putting this vote to the board, what's the goal?
Well, first of all, are we on the same page, Kurt, with regard, and this is Chuck, with regard to the fact that there was quite a bit of support in the group, strong support and even consensus support on the idea of a string being rejected requiring a higher threshold from the board to approve it going into the root than just any other string that might go into the root? Was that understood by staff and ultimately the board?
Yeah, so it wasn't clear from the paper, but if I understand what you're saying and can accept it.
Okay.
I don't see how that if you lose in an objection, if you're a government and you lose in an objection, why you can't go to the board where a private entity that loses it at an objection does get to go to the board?
I don't think I followed that in terms of losing. What we're talking about,
the report says that only losing applicants can go to the board for review.
No.
Is that what you say? No?
I think it's what Robin's saying. I don't know if that's what the report says.
Right. That's what I'm trying to understand.
And I'm not sure, somebody help me out here on the working group, but I'm not sure that the intent of the working group was that all losers get to go to the board. With regard to Recommendation 6 issues, if a string is denied, and I think this is what Robin said, and in the language that that Margie referred to in the actual recommendations, the idea was is that there be a higher threshold of denial of a string than just approval of a string. So if I have stated that incorrectly, please correct me. And I see Amy's hands up. Go ahead.
So, Chuck, I thank you. I appreciate that. I think I've tried to clarify the language with Robin earlier, and so maybe the group can weigh in on this just so I understand what we're trying to say. So the working group agrees that objections can be filed with a dispute resolution provider. That dispute resolution provider makes a determination. If the determination is in favor of the objector, meaning an application is rejected, then that would be brought to the board for resolution or consideration?
That is my understanding. Does anybody have a different understanding? Please raise your hand if you do.
I think the term we used at some point was for ratification.
And I don't think, and again, I don't want to be the spokesperson for the group because I may misrepresent, so keep me honest, everybody. But the idea was...
Go ahead, Chuck.
Yeah, the idea...
All I can say is that that's not the way the report reads. And so if that's what the intent is, I certainly appreciate that clarification, but that is not what the report says.
Okay, and several people have commented on that, and that's quite possible. But I do believe that that's an accurate – what we're saying today is accurate. And it wasn't unanimous support. It wasn't full consensus, but it was strong and at a consensus level. And the idea was not that the board's expected to have all this expertise and make and have to get the expertise themselves, but rather to rely on the information from the expert provider and – to require a higher threshold for denying the string than just so in other words, a little more due diligence is going to be necessary in reviewing the data, but not necessarily to be the experts.
Okay, so then I read 4.2, and then I get a little confused with 4.2 because it says that the board shall contract appropriate expert resources. So. Would that mean after the dispute resolution determination is issued, the board would then go find other experts?
That's not what I recall. What I recall, and I'm doing too much of the talking, I think, so help me out, especially if I'm off base. My recollection was that was a recommendation that we support the idea of an expert recommendation panel. But I don't recall us talking about, the board going out and getting new experts on these particular cases. Let me call on some other people. Evan, please.
Hi, everybody. I think part of the reason we're going around the block so many times is because you'll notice that the term dispute resolution service provider exists nowhere in that document. Kurt, you mentioned that this is a cornerstone of the way you were planning to do this. And I think part of the real big issue, 30,000 feet point of this, is that there is a fundamental problem in big parts of the community with that cornerstone. And the fact that the DRSP is so central to things, it is at the center of all sorts of problems about who is going to be picked. It's at the problem of creating huge amounts of expense for both the objector and for the applicant. It's about a very easy system to be gamed or to have an applicant spent into oblivion. There were all sorts of problems with this, and it wasn't, you know, it either wasn't seen or it was shoved off or whatever. The community essentially had said this cornerstone of what is in the application guidebook was not acceptable. And what is so astounding is that except for what seems to be almost cosmetic changes, there isn't a whole lot of fundamental change, even though the report has been calling for fundamental change. There is no DRSP mentioned anywhere in the report, and there's a reason for that. And I really want you to tell us, first of all, why are we having this call the weekend, the day after the release of the application guidebook instead of before? If there's so much confusion, as you're seeing happening, you knew this was coming, you knew that there would be community feedback, you knew that there would be a lot of issues where you weren't quite sure what the working group was getting at, why wasn't this done before the release of the document, not after, and putting everyone in a really much more difficult state to be able to deal with this and fix it?
Now, I'd like to suggest that we don't spend time going down that path, and rather we look at trying to be constructive in terms of mutual understanding and possible changes in the guidebook. Is that okay? Anybody object to that? So,
okay,
any questions of Evan, Kurt, or Amy?
Yeah, I do. I have three things to say. One is that this dispute resolution policy and procedure have been in the guidebook since Guidebook 2. Just about exactly the same. So,
and at large has been calling for its abolition since the summit in Mexico City. Just because it wasn't listened to doesn't mean the objection to that process isn't almost as old as it's being there.
Two, it's in the GNSO's policy implementation guidelines. So it was voted on and approved by the GNSO as part of the policy to have external dispute resolution providers will give decisions on objections. So that is the policy we were given to implement, and we implemented it. And third, with respect to likelihood of gaming, that is exactly why dispute resolution providers, internationally renowned dispute resolution providers such as the ICC, develop rules for how to manage dispute resolution processes in a way that gets to a fair, fact-based result and not one that is ad hoc and susceptible to lobbying or public comment, but rather is subject to a clear, proven set of rules administered by a set of experts.
What about the ability for one side to outspend the other?
There's rules in the dispute resolution procedures about what documents are required, the timing of the documents, and what's included. So there's participants in that procedure can get a clear idea before launching into the process of what it's going to take to participate in that process.
No, that's not what I meant. I meant an objector that's very, very well funded could basically launch objection after slightly different objection after slightly different objection and essentially spend an applicant into oblivion.
Well, you know, there's consolidation of hearings. There's an open and close period for objections. So, again, the rules were meant to take that into account. And I think that's different from the ability to lobby board members repeatedly. So, you know what? You know, Evan, you know, you and I have talked a lot, and I think, you know, we want exactly the same result. And I'm just trying to get to an understanding of why we think the board might be better suited to make a decision on an objection. You know, we've spent, you know, I know there's been a lot of denigration on this, but honestly, we've made investments on essentially the best expertise in the world in this area to implement this policy recommendation. And when it was first done, I looked at it, and I guess I'm wrong, but I thought it was, you know, some of the best work and research that ICANN's ever done. And So I'm just looking for something to hang my hat on to say, why we'd want the board to make this call, because I want the same result. I want the same result of this process as you. I want to, you know, I want us all, you know, everybody in this virtual room, you know, worked on this darn thing. And, you know, it's something we all want to reflect back on and say we did a good job.
That's why I'm asking, why didn't we have this conversation last week instead of this week?
Anyway,
I'm as open to this as you are.
Evan, we didn't, so let's just move to what we can do. And maybe going back to Amy's question at some point, Chuck, would be a good idea as well.
Yes, let's go to Alan.
Well, timing is good. I was going to go back to Amy's question. I think one of the issues, and it was alluded to by what Evan was saying, is there was a feeling among at least some of the people on the working group that they didn't want this to be an external dispute mechanism, but just expert services. So we uniformly use the term expert panel in the document instead of dispute resolution. So if there's anything unclear, it is the same part in the process, not two consecutive ones. There were differences among the people on the group, and most of them got reflected well in the report on the measure of consensus. Not all of them probably did. This is one which may not have made it as well into the report. There were certainly some people on the group who felt it was acceptable for the external body that denies an objection to let that stand without board action. At that point, it effectively is a dispute resolution mechanism because it isn't going to another party to ratify it. But there was a strong feeling and pretty much unanimous that the board must take action if a TLD is going to be refused. And the rationale for it, I think, was a matter of perception that ICANN wanted, that the people felt that ICANN should be perceived as a group which is open to letting things into the root and has to take extraordinary action to bar it, as opposed to you have to go through somersaults to get something into the root, you know, other than the application form and stuff like that. So it was a matter very much of perception that the board should have to take action to reject it, not because they're smarter than the outside panel, but because it's something that we don't want to encourage censorship of the form that some people saw in this this type of objection. And by asking for the board to ratify it, rubber stamp, if you will, that put a measure of importance on it. And I may not be using the right words, but I think that was the tone that I got from the meetings. Thank you.
Amy, did you get the answer to what you were looking for?
I think from what Alan just said and from what I've heard previously is that the intent is different than what the paper said. And but I do believe I understood what Alan said in terms of the fact that it would be a dispute resolution process all the way up until the point where an objection is sustained or, in other words, an application is rejected by the dispute resolution panel. And then at that point, there'd be a next step. What I'm still unclear about, though, is that if at that point, the next step, if the board is required to take a, I know Alan said possibly ratify or rubber stamp or whatever the case may be, are they supposed to do an independent evaluation of the objection papers and all of those things? That's what I'm still unclear about, what the board's role would be in that regard.
I would assume that they're supposed to read the judgment, if nothing else, which presumably gives a rationale for why that judgment is made. By the way, I should point out there were some people in the group who really didn't want it to be a dispute resolution mechanism at all, and that was certainly reflected in what Evan was saying. And that may be indicative of why the wording is somewhat confusing. But I think certainly the most important issue among most of the people on the group or all was how rejections are handled, and that's why the differences come in.
Okay, I think we're going to need to move on from this and go to the next issue. We're way over time on this one, although it's a biggie. It's a biggie for the working group. I recognize that. So
Chuck?
Yes, Kurt.
So is a takeaway to look at a – well, I'm afraid to say anything. First of all, I want to say that when I read the report, you know, I read that the board's supposed to look at every application and applications that are so-called normal or not rejected by an objection process just require a majority of the board, and applications that are rejected by the dispute resolution provider require two-thirds. I understand there's some clarification of the report, which is really dangerous over the phone. So we kind of have two different interpretations going on at the same time. But I'm understanding that at least starting to look at some sort of board review of the rejected applications is a step towards, you know, what this group is looking for.
I think that's accurate.
Correct.
And Frank, since you're the other, you really filled in for Heather. Would you concur with that?
Yes, I think so. There was recall concern within the GAC about external experts taking over responsibility for board decisions in critical areas, and I think that the wording of the report as it came through accurately reflected that concern. It may not be as clear as it should have been, but certainly there had to be a balance between the workload of the board and the need for the board to recognize and take full responsibility. I think we achieved it, isn't it?
Thank you. Okay, let's go on then to Working Group Issue 2, which is terminology, criteria, and references. Kurt, would you like to just do a quick overview on that?
Sure. I was talking into the mute. Regarding changing the name and other language, we reviewed the group recommendations for the name, and as already been pointed out in email, the name might not really even matter, and it's nonetheless we looked at the different names and didn't pick any of them, but tried to pick something that we thought public interest objection might be too broad, so we put the word limited in front of it and picked that as what we thought the best, but it's clearly bracketed in the guidebook and meant the bracketed language with the change is more an intent to flag that we're interested in discussing what the name of it should be, and the name of course affects other things in it, so we think it's important, it's our best try on it so far, but an indication that we can talk about it and change the name. Two, with regard to the treaties, we added the terms in the treaties, and that, you're going to have to help me with this one, Amy.
Yeah.
Change in terms and standards such as brought in the discrimination. So we saw that. I thought this came up later. So we did not change the name of the standard having to do with discrimination. And I'll say a couple of things about that. One is what it said here, that, the standard for discrimination was really based on what countries that limit such words, what the collective opinion of what discrimination is in those jurisdictions. Two is that the working group recommendation broadened that. So it broadened the definition, which means that more names would be kept out. And, especially given the discussion we just had last time, we saw a lot of discussion in the working group about that the morality and public order objection should be limited in scope and narrow. And there are many advocates for very vocal advocates for making the objection narrow and not broadening it. Yet this change in recommendation really got full consensus. So it's something we wanted to talk to you about, because the result of this will be, in fact, to keep more names out. And then third, in changing the name of the standard, we included, and this is in a later issue, but included, am I screwing up?
Oh, keep going.
Okay.
I'll
so,
stop you when you are.
All right. So included discrimination based on political beliefs, which we think would be an incredible broadening of it, because all political beliefs essentially discriminate against some other political belief. And then finally, the last thing we talked about was the quick look procedure, and there were clarification requests for language, you know, language in that. So we provided more definitions.
And let me open it up for a cue, please. Somebody want to respond here? Comment? Anybody want to comment on the limited public interest objection term? Anybody have a problem with that? I mean, does that is that okay? What about this idea on discrimination? Robin?
Okay. Yes, so on the limited public interest name, I think we need to change the name. We took a poll through the group, and that public interest objections was among the lowest that was polled. So it seems to me that that's probably not the name that should be selected, since it was the one that that received the smallest amount of support from the community. It looks like the one that received the strongest support was objections based on general principles of international law. So that would be my recommendation there. What was the other issue was
discrimination.
Right. Yeah. I found that the examples that were given to justify that didn't really seem to make sense. That you know, to say ICANN can discriminate giving a domain to somebody because of their political opinion. And then they cite a bunch of examples about how political parties are allowed to not give people jobs, but, you know, that's not really even in the ballpark of, you know, people getting or companies getting domain names. So I think the examples that are cited for why ICANN should be allowed to discriminate based on political or other opinion really don't match at all the reality. I mean, people getting domain names is not like trying to apply for a job in the political party. You got to have the political view. I mean, we all have to have the ICANN view in order to get a domain name. I mean, this just doesn't make any sense. So, you know, I just felt like it was a little sloppy in terms of some of the analysis that was put forward, the justifications that were put forward. So those were my points on those two issues that you mentioned.
Now, first a general comment, just a second, Kurt, if you make sure, everyone, that you participate in the public comment process. Don't just rely on this session to make your points. Please submit your comments to the comment session. And secondly, it's a clarification question. Either I misunderstood Robin or I misunderstood Kurt, but I thought Kurt was kind of saying the same thing you were, Robin. Did I miss something there?
Well, that would be nice, but the impression that I got was that we'll let Kurt tell us what he means.
Okay, that's good. Kurt?
So first of all, I want to point out that our suggestion for the name got zero votes. And I was going to ask Robin the same question. So we were thinking that the and I kind of messed up. We talk about this in a later issue, but the discrimination standard suggested by the working group would keep out more names. It would keep out names based on discrimination of political belief. So we are advocating keeping it narrow. The narrowness we have is based on our survey of restrictions in different countries. A slight broadening along the lines of some of the suggestions of the working group would broaden it somewhat, and then including discrimination based on political belief would broaden it a lot, and we are not for broadening accepting an objection based on discrimination for political or other things. So I think well, knowing your past position on these issues, Robin, I think we agree on that.
Okay, so I appreciate that clarification. So you're saying you would not allow objections based upon political views or opinions.
Right, but the full consensus of the working group said we should.
I appreciate your clarification on that.
Thank you. Let's go to Aubrey.
Yeah, I think what the thank you, this is Aubrey. I think what the group said was talking about restricting for incitement against various groups. And so it was dealing with, as long as you were going to have a clause that said inciting against people on a certain basis, then you should broaden that, for example, to include incitement against the disabled, or to include incitement against the gay, or incitement against a minority population or a political opinion. It was not saying that we think you should exclude people because of their political opinion or exclude people because they are disabled, but rather that you should exclude, if you're going to have an incitement clause at all, and if you're going to say that a valid basis for excluding a name is a name that incites against a certain class of people, that class of people should include the disabled, should include gender variants, should include minority populations and political opinion. So it's not quite the way you just interpreted that we were suggesting that you do it. And I understand the implications that came out in Paul's note that sort of looked at the political condition and said you could twist that to perhaps say that a certain name was incitement against a political cause and misuse that. And perhaps there's something to be discussed in that area. I didn't quite understand Paul's point, but I did, you know, I could see something. But there was nothing in his comment that said that the same thing goes for the disabled or the same thing goes for LGBTQ people. So I think that you threw out quite a bit. As I say, if you want to get rid of an incitement clause, then there's nothing for us to argue about. But as long as you have an incitement clause, you should include all the categories of people that are currently being included in more and more of national standards. Thank you.
Thanks, Aubrey. Let's go through the queue here just a little bit, and then we'll come back to Kurt. And I see Amy has her hand up, so we'll go there. Konstantinos.
Yes, thank you very much, Chuck. I would like to raise the issue of incitement and instigation, which seems not to have been taken on board. And if I recall, the replacement of the term incitement with incitement and instigation received the consensus of the working group, and it was meant to serve as a two-pronged test. Because of the difficulties that the group identified in finding GTLDs, a simple word that would incite anyone to do something, we thought that it would have been beneficial and in compliance with international criminal law to add an extra prong. And it is quite concerning to see that staff is willing to replace the end with an or, basically broadening again, once again, the standard instead of making it more specific, which was the original intention of the group. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Konstantinos. Carol.
Yes, thank you, Chuck. This is Carol. I was going to return to the point that Aubrey was just making about discrimination. And you have to remember here, what we're looking at are the grounds upon which an applied-for string might be successfully objected to? In other words, what are the grounds for an objection that would be sustained? And so every additional ground, you know, expands the possibilities of blocking an applied for string. In the work that we did with ICANN, we looked at laws around the world and tried to identify certain bases for discrimination, that is, where there are commonly accepted rules, commonly accepted norms. In other words, it's widely accepted that discrimination on the basis of race is barred under international treaties and national laws. There are other types of discrimination, other types of distinguishing among people that may be barred under one country's laws but not others.
Hi there.
And so the idea in pursuing the notion of norms that are widely accepted under principles of international law, in other words, individual states which all tend to agree that there should not be discrimination on the basis of race, for example, you can identify that norm. You cannot identify a similar norm for all the other grounds of discrimination that have been suggested by the working group. And in fact, the example that was given in the chart there is that discrimination on the basis of political opinions is in fact perfectly acceptable in many instances, certainly among private parties. Media companies, for example, or other companies are entitled to select whom they hire or select whose views they express or whatever on the basis of political opinions. And even in the examples given in the chart there, governments have a certain scope for doing that. So it does not seem that a string which incites or promotes discrimination on the basis of, say, political opinions is worthy of an objection under principles of international law or even most national laws. So that's the underlying rationale for maintaining the standards, the criteria that were originally set out, and not expanding them to bring in new grounds for possible objections that would block applied for strings.
Thank you, Carol. And thanks again for participating in one of our calls and being very helpful in that regard.
Oh, you're welcome.
Any other comments on this category, issue two? Okay. Yes, Cheryl, go ahead.
Constantinos has put in a question to the chat that might be worthwhile at least having as a question with notice, if not discussed in the call.
So the question is, can we have an example of a string that incites or promotes anyone to do anything? Anybody want to respond to that? Carol, go ahead.
Sure. First of all, remind you that strings run up to 63 characters, and so a complete extensive sentence would be possible. I think in the call that I participated in last time, we talked about some examples. The example that was I mentioned.
Yeah, Carol, this is Amy. Can I jump in just for a moment, please?
Sure.
I'm just going to caution everybody of using specific examples. I'm just, I just don't think that's a very good idea. I think you can put blanks in places if you'd like.
Sure. Well, then I'll just put in kill the blanks, and you can supply various options. And there were, there have been actual trials of people, individuals, for incitement to genocide, and people have been tried. They've been appellate proceedings under those, and they've been imprisoned for inciting to genocide. And I think the point here is that you can certainly incite a person to do some act with words, and the question is how many words, what do they say, what's the context. It's certainly a possibility, and whether or not any eventual string will incite to violent lawless action or some of those other categories remains to be seen. And if it turns out that it's difficult to find an example, then I think we could all celebrate and be pleased that there isn't that problem. But as far as a theoretical possibility, incitement is certainly a incitement to certain crimes. It exists. It's something that can be done, and it can certainly be recognized as a category for barring a string.
Thank you, Carol. Anyone else have a comment on this area before we move on?
Yeah, this is Kurt. I just want to indicate, too, that the panelists may consider the purpose of the TLD, too, that there's in the application form, the applicant is asked to provide the purpose.
So that would deal a little bit, at least, with the context that Robin mentioned on the chat.
Certainly you can consider context. We discussed that last time, and the context would be one of the things that an expert panel could hear submissions on and make a decision upon. And it can certainly look at individual words, and words themselves can incite action. And that's in my mind, there's no doubt about that, if you can consider also their context.
Thank you, Carol. Aubrey.
Yes, thank you. I just wanted to ask a quick question. So if I understand what you said, while it may be reasonable from what you stated for someone to be accused and eliminated because they incited someone to kill or damage or maim because of one's race, and at that you see as reasonable to damage or kill or maim because they were disabled or because they were gay, wouldn't be a problem for you and shouldn't be something that is seen as equal to race.
What you're describing there is incitement to violent, lawless action. And that settles it right there.
But it's not in one of the categories that you're protecting.
Yes, it is. It's in the category of incitement to violent, lawless action. And on those grounds alone, the string would be objected to successfully.
So, okay, then I'll shut up on this one because I know people need to move on. So you're saying that if it was a string that translated in discriminate against someone because of their race, that would be wrong, but discriminate against someone because of their disability, not lawless action, just discriminate, that would be a significant difference to you.
Well, what we're suggesting is there are certain categories of discrimination that have been recognized very widely as norms in international practice and among in national states laws as being prohibited.
Okay, I suggest you're not looking far enough. That you're not looking at changes that are happening in the world now in terms of their discrimination laws.
Oh,
and that you're discriminating in that case. But thank you.
Maybe that could evolve.
Okay. Kurt, is it okay to move on?
So I put up I kind of put up three choices, right? A, B, and C. And even though the report says full consensus, I understand from this call that there's not. So, A, choice A essentially is the one standard for discrimination by staff. Two is a slightly broader one that doesn't include discrimination for political beliefs, and three would be the very broad one that includes discrimination against political beliefs. So I don't know, I don't want to make a decision on this call, but from listening to the call, I really understand that there's people for each one of those.
Hey, Carol, did you still have your hand up?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I
That's okay.
I'm a little new at this system here.
Yes.
I'll take it down if I can figure out how to do so.
Okay. Olivier.
Thank you, Chuck. I just heard that ICANN would be looking at the content or context of a GTLD application. Does that mean that ICANN will then track the content of a website, so on, under a GTLD after it's allocated this GTLD, after it's actually allowed it?
I suspect there's a real easy answer to that. Do you want to give it, Chris? Kurt, excuse me?
Yeah, the answer is no, unless what ICANN will enforce is registration restrictions based on a community application.
Okay, thank you. Anything else, Kurt, before we move on?
No.
Okay, thanks. Let's go to issue 3, and I'll turn it back to Kurt.
Okay, this recommendation has to go to the IO. So I think here's the big picture idea for this one is that here's our reading of the report and a possible way to go forward on this. When the role of the independent objector was developed, it was developed in response to community questions about, you know, who would object if nobody objects, and to a clearly objectionable string. And so the narrowest way we found to answer that, you know, in a way that would keep the scope of objections narrow, is put this in the hand of a single individual with accountability back to the process that was clear and measurable. And reading the report, the report specified other tasks for the IO different than the one that's envisaged. So, you know, what maybe we could discuss to kind of get right to the heart of this issue is that, you know, maybe discussing, looking at the goals of the working group, you know, as far as, you know, providing information or advice to potential objectors, or, you know, helping them through the objection process. We could talk about how to accomplish some of those goals through an individual that, you know, is either an augmented IO or probably more appropriately separate from the IO role, that should be kept separate from other things. And so that was my first take at this, was that we were looking for a way to preserve the role of the IO, but also find ways of accomplishing, you know, some of the working group recommendations.
So in this particular case, no changes were made in the guidebook. Is that correct, Kurt?
I'm sorry, what did you say, Chuck?
There were no changes made in the guidebook on this one. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay. Evan.
Large, who's unfortunately not on the call, her name is Hong Zhui from AP Rallo, and she is sort of our expert on the IO, and she said she had some comments. So there might be some issues, but I don't think they can be raised adequately on this call because she's not here.
And I please encourage her to submit those in the comment forum as soon as possible. Robin.
Yeah, I'm a bit puzzled about the insistence on having an IO in the original vision that the staff created it. I mean, it's worth pointing out that the IO was not something that the GNSO recommended. It is entirely a creature of staff creation as a way of managing risk, as it says in this document. So I'm a bit concerned when the community says, well, we really don't like the shape of this IO. We're concerned that it's an unchecked gun. We're concerned that without actually requiring a complaint to be tied to a particular individual or company or somebody, an entity that claims to be harmed, that it's dangerous. But then it just, you know, you just said, well, too bad. This is it's not consistent with what we had originally planned, so we're not going to go forward with it. I mean, how can you justify that and say that this is a bottom-up policy-making process when this creature that's entirely staff-created in the first place isn't allowed to be altered in any way by the community based upon the community's concerns about its potential for abuse?
Let's go ahead and go to Richard, and then we'll let Kurt or Amy or anyone else respond.
Thanks, Chuck. This is Richard. I just wanted really to comment on Robin's observation there. I don't think that there's uniform community view that what's in the guidebook about independent objector is wrong. I think there were multiple comments in favor of the independent objector. Certainly in several versions of the guidebook, I've personally indicated that I think that the independent objector is a good idea. So I think there is probably a diversity of opinion in the community about whether the IO in the guidebook is a good thing.
Thank you, Richard. Carol?
Yes, I just wanted to, maybe it's clear enough, and I don't want to overdo things here. However, in listening to some of the comments and criticism of the IO, I think there may be some misunderstanding of what it really is, status is, and it's how it would operate. It would not be correct to say that the IO is sort of unchecked in his or her actions and is a sort of a loose cannon or sort of exercises some sort of untrammeled power. And the IO, in connection with Recommendation 6 proceedings, would have no greater or lesser status or power than any other objector. And if the IO starts throwing his or her weight around and making completely frivolous or unfair objections, they will be dismissed the way any other abusive or unfounded objection could be dismissed under the quick look procedure. And if the IO submits an objection that is unfounded on its merits, it'll be dismissed, and the applicant would recover its costs. An IO that makes repeated unfounded objections would probably lose a lot of credibility and certainly would be unlikely to be reappointed. So it's really not such a wild and dangerous institution. It has a fairly limited purpose, which is explained, I think, well enough in the memoranda, and it is not really such a great threat to the smooth running of the system that I think some of the critics have suggested.
Thank you, Carol. Robin?
Yeah, thanks. It seems like we've got sort of statements that don't make any sense. On the one hand, we're saying if nobody's objected to a string, yet it's clearly objectionable. Well, let me get this straight. It's clearly objectionable, but no person in the world, no religion in the world, no country in the world, no company in the world has objected to this string, yet somehow it's supposed to be clearly objectionable. I mean, obviously, these are contradictory statements, contradictory goals. One of the important criteria for this whole process is that it's supposed to be transparent. It's supposed to be objective. You're supposed to know going in when you apply for a new TLD what the rules are. You're supposed to know what kinds of objections can be laid. But you're telling us that even if no country, no person, no religion, no company, nobody in the world objects, there's still supposed to be some kind of expectation that there could be an objection based upon this IO. I mean, it seems like we are creating a solution that doesn't have a problem.
Carol.
Well, just briefly, it may well be rare that the independent objector objects, but there are also sometimes there could be various reasons why countries or institutions, individuals would choose not to object, even though they may consider it objectionable. And that's one of the situations where the IO may well be moved to file an objection. So the paradox of the highly objectionable string to which no one files an objection is possible, could come to pass for various specific reasons relating to politics, finance, and other factors which inhibit or discourage individuals or institutions or states from filing an objection.
But keep in mind, this is a governance process, an open, transparent process. We're not supposed to be having governments filing, you know, secret requests somewhere to block something. This is supposed to be an open, transparent process. We're not supposed to be creating secrecy sorts of mechanisms so people can object to other people's domain names without having to come forward and say that they're objecting. I think your goals are off in this case.
Now, one of the suggestions that is in this issue, with regard to this issue, is the idea that the IO must submit an objection if the GAC or ALAC request it. Anybody from the GAC or ALAC want to comment on that?
I had my hand up, Chuck, simply because it was quite amazing. It was a psychic connection, as I was about to say. Chuck, I've got my hand up. I just wanted to bring the attention to 10.2, which was a consensus point in our report, where we did make the point, if requested in writing by the GAC or ALAC, the independent objector will prepare and submit a relevant objection. The independent objector will liaise with the GAC or ALAC in drafting such an objection. Any objection initiated from a GAC or ALAC request will go through exactly the same process as an objection from any other source and must meet the same standard for success as an objection from any other source. And to a great extent, in return to what reply to what Carrick was just raising, that was how the work group from a GAC and ALAC point of view felt we were addressing some of what you were alluding to in your statements. And I would the GAC in particular, and their representatives need to weigh in now because most of us live in a highly politicised environment and are well aware that there are things that can be done in more than one way. So we were actually proposing a change which we thought would strengthen and yet give greater transparency to the processes as well as accountability. Go ahead.
Thanks, Frank. I don't have to call on anybody generally for the GAC. Not that you're necessarily speaking for the GAC, but please go ahead.
Let me be absolutely assuring that I am not speaking on behalf of the GAC. But in terms of the GAC being involved here, there's a lot of debate, I think, around the question of whether governments were going to pay for objections or not. And this is a mechanism for governments being able to object without compromising principles about who would pay for what and under what circumstances. It was using the facility of an independent objector to place an objection into the system, not to bypass anything other than the standard procedures for lodging a payment in order to have an objection on the floor, so to speak. That's my recollection. I don't think it was anything more complicated than that.
Thank you very much, Frank. Appreciate it. Kurt, Amy, any questions with regard to this issue?
Well, their statements, of course, Cheryl, here, their statements, of course, seem to indicate that the IO would serve at the pleasure of the GAC or ALAC and that this mechanism would somehow infringe on their independence and the mandate to act in public interest. I think it would be remiss of the ALAC, and I suspect GAC would be, at least in some member countries, of similar mind, that our role in ICANN is very much in the public interest. And so to do anything counter to that would be unthinkable.
Thank you, Cheryl. Any other comments on this area? Kurt, any clarification questions you have?
Yeah, so we've had a lot of discussions about how would ALAC or how would the GAC object, through what mechanism, in order to, so the independent objector is supposed to be an independent objector, so he or she is supposed to be independent. But if so, But this discussion really isn't about that. This discussion is really about ALAC or GAC being able to object to a TLD string that they wouldn't have to pay, and that they'd have lower, that they would just have to meet lower standards. So I don't know what lower standards are, but you know, I'd be cautious of a veto. And third is, you know, by what procedure. So before we'd be able to proceed on something like that, you know, we'd have to know the answer to those three, right? What, you know, what constitutes an objection by the GAC? Is it a vote by one country, so it's essentially a veto by any country of a name, or does it require some sort of vote, or, you know, the GAC really doesn't vote, right? It arrives at consensus positions. Same thing for the ALAC. The ALAC is, not ALAC, but, you know, at large is, you know, the broad representation of all Internet users, right? So is the ALAC, a star chamber for lodging objection, and how do they get to where they would object to a name? And then, we have to provide clarity for applicants. That's one of the first two policy recommendations. And then, and I know it sounds parochial, but then, you know, we have to pay for it. Despite the protestations of many, it's a zero-sum game, and, you know, I've looked at numbers, and it's right on it. It's zero sum, the way to pay for this is to increase fees by some unknown amount, so that we're sure the cost is covered in what's a very uncertain area. And we thought the most economical way to do that would be to attach the cost to the transaction itself, and it being a loser-pays deal, then, those lodging successful objections really don't have to pay anyway. So it's three questions then, right? What's the mechanism? What's the cost? And, who does it?
Hey, Frank.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I wasn't sure quite what set my phone was in. I'm in some difficulty with this because I'm trying to interpret issues that I think the GAC put on the table, but ones which I don't necessarily fully understand myself or necessarily have any sympathy from a New Zealand government point of view. Please, any other Stefano or Heather, if leap in and contradict me if I've got it wrong. The issue here is that the GAC would not necessarily be unanimous, of course, about an objection. There may be an individual member of the GAC, an individual government, that had concerns. And the discussion was around the issue of whether, under those circumstances, the GAC would put an objection in or not. And there was the issue of governments paying or not otherwise, and I do recall many conversations in the GAC about concerns about governments paying to lodge objections and objections to that procedure and so on. So this is an attempt to forestall those sorts of arguments. So the answer to your question, I think, Kurt, about when the GAC would put an objection would be if any member of the GAC had a concern, that would be the mechanism for putting it forward. Now, as I say, I'm very happy to be contradicted on that point, but I think that was the issue. And it's not one that's been discussed in this context within the GAC, of course, because the GAC has not had an opportunity to respond to the report of the group and has not discussed it. That's about all I can say at this point. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Alan.
Yeah, just to address the point that Frank was just making, conversation I had with individuals gave me the impression, but it was nothing more than an impression, that a GAC objection could not be based on a single GAC member objecting, but would require some number, or not necessarily a majority, but some reasonable critical mass. But that's just an impression I got from individual conversations. I wanted to point out that if there is a fee associated with a GAC objection or an ALAC objection, you're essentially saying there will be no GAC or ALAC objection. These bodies don't have any large amounts of money, and certainly not one that could be unlimited if the dispute went on into an expensive position. So I just say there are they can object, but they have to pay for them. But that effectually says they can't object. So
going to make budgeting and strategy meetings interesting.
Well, it does indeed. And I'm presuming ICANN is not going to give both advisory committees an unlimited budget in case we choose to object. And it's rather moot to begin with, even if they do. The related thing is, I understand the concept of zero-sum game. My recollection is the independent objector, though, was going to be funded by ICANN, that it's not some benevolent source in the world who's decided to put an unlimited amount of money into the GTLD process. So we're already violating the zero-sum game with the concept of the independent objector. Now we're just quibbling over how many objections there are and who has the right to say there are. So unless I'm mistaken and there is a source of funds independent of this whole project for the independent objector, then we need to use the same rationale and reason for filling one concept as opposed to the other. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Amy.
Thank you, Chuck. I just wanted to point out, though, that one thing that I don't want to get lost is the fact that through public comment, the GAC, the ALAC, any individual member of the GAC, any member of at large who believe that there is something that it would be in the public interest will be influential on the independent objector. The concern that that is out there is that by allowing the GAC or ALAC to require the independent objector to file something, is that it will lose independence. And so I don't want it to get lost that there's going to be, you know, public comment that the independent objector will review and will take seriously if there is significant public interest out there for an objection. I suspect that the independent objector will take that very seriously.
Thank you, Amy. Evan.
I just wanted to say I agree with you there, but there's a big distinction between requiring the IO to consider something and requiring the IO to put it forward. So as long as there's some specific guidelines that the IO can use as a filter to get rid of things that don't meet the criteria, I don't have a problem with obligating the IO to at least look at stuff as long as the independence is there to not have to put things forward that appear frivolous or not meeting the criteria.
Chuck, may I?
Yes.
And Evan, that's exactly the way it is. The IO, as I believe Carol had indicated earlier, must comply with all of the requirements and cannot file frivolous complaints just like and no one else can. They will be subject to the quick look procedure like everybody else. So I think we're in agreement on that, Evan.
On that particular issue, yeah. Like I say, there's others on which I'm not really totally qualified to talk about, and so I'd have to defer to Hongo. I'm going to encourage her to send her comments in. On that particular issue, yeah, I think we're in agreement.
Thank you. Well, you know, we have two more issues to cover. If there are no objections, let's move on to issue number four. And Kurt, over to you.
Yeah, I just want to, I think it's already been said, but I just want to answer Alan's comment about money more specifically. I think that for reasons Carol described earlier, the independent objector is incented to get her or his objections correct. In other words, only object in cases where the objection will be upheld and his or her performance will be more or less judged based on that, as Carol described, whereas a single government or how the at-large community decides to file objections is really based on a lot less. So I think it really there really is a discussion to be had about how it's funded. So anyway, I'll
So I'll cut Alan off from any response to my comment and go on to issue four, which is really about the procedure. So that was broken up into several recommendations, some of which have already been incorporated into the guidebook, and we might not have to discuss. Some have been discussed already, and others we can discuss. So regarding notification from governments, that's been included in the guidebook. Requiring a supermajority of the board vote to uphold an objection, we had quite a discussion about that earlier, and I think our takeaway is to look at ways the board might review objections as part of the overall process, but you know, and it might not reach the two-thirds vote, and might, you know, so a point I didn't make earlier that I should have made is, you know, what you're reading is really the result of board discussion as much as anything. So it was clearly a board discussion around the role of the board, even without the consideration of the work of the Recommendation 6 Working Group, but overall the board discussion of their role. There was a recommendation about Recommendation 6 objections should be resolved earlier. So, you know, we want to resolve them as early as possible. And on the other hand, we see no need to undertake the process that's somewhat lengthy and expensive if an application hasn't met certain other requisite criteria first. So we want to encourage early resolution, but also do it economically for the parties. So it's sort of, you know, we see it as a recommendation to strive for. Regarding the use of the community objection, we certainly see and have already often said that the community-based objection is a way to address concerns raised in the GAC principles under GTLDs, that issues that governments have with cultural, linguistic, or place certain place strings can be resolved in the community objection process. And in fact, in the policy development discussions and the formation of these objections, that was one of the key reasons for implementing the community objection. Again, the methodology by which the GAC or ALAC can lodge an objection, we still see is kind of problematic. You know, what are the rules around this? We think that there shouldn't be individual veto or veto of applications, so we see as it important to build a predictable process around that, and It's certainly, a community objection standard is, to lower those standards means after some evaluation, lowering the community standards means that, a TLD string that really doesn't create harm to communities can be, objected to and lose out. And the standards were fairly carefully crafted with a lot of community input to arrive at those standards and have it, set of standards we see as sort of unprecedented. Fees we've already talked about is, the fees are really, we're just trying to pay for what we're doing, and that to us that are implementing the process, although you may not believe it, the $185,000 fee is painfully low, and that the resolution of the dispute should take into account the purpose of the TLD. So that I think has been incorporated into the guidebook in some way, or certainly is something we agree with that sentiment.
Thank you. Thank you, Kurt. Frank, did you have your hand up for this one?
Apologies. I
I don't. I'm taking it down.
Okay. Thanks. Okay.
Chuck, can I continue for 1 second?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, because we might run short of time. I just want to go on to issue 5 and say that, in the end, we made this bucket of a statement of, about the process and the intent of the process, and, we agree with everything in that. We can talk more about that at the end, but I just wanted to let the group know that we think there's less to talk about in that recommendation, but we can kind of talk about it right at the end. Anyway,
okay.
I was just trying to manage time.
Good. I appreciate that. I'm sure others do as well. Let's open it up for issue 4. Anybody want to get in the queue there? We've kind of talked about some elements of it, like Kurt already indicated, in particular the two-thirds vote to uphold an objection. Any new thoughts, questions on issue 4? Robin.
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, it just seems to me when I read the ICANN response and rationale on page 18 to 4.1 and then right underneath it 4.2, they seem to contradict each other. 4.1 says that the board has ultimate responsibility, and 4.2 says we're going to outsource that responsibility to a DSRP. So, it just seems to me that it's sort of doublespeak here. It's trying to have it both ways, and it's not really the case. I mean, the board isn't really going to be making final determinations if it's going to rely upon a determination of an outside panel. So it just seems to me that these are two contradictory statements, and you kind of have to pick one or the other, but you can't have it both ways.
Thank you, Robin. Response on that?
We don't see it that way. We see the board as having ultimate authority for the program. Just, you can characterize it as a PLDs is bigger than UDRP, but relying on UDRP, and the board will rely on independent evaluators to evaluate the financial and technical wherewithal of the applicants to, operate a TLD, and the board's going to rely on experts to determine string similarity from a visual case and whether the TLD string itself meets the technical criteria as put out by the IETF. So we're not asking the board to make that determination. We're giving the IETF RFC to a technical panel and asking them to provide an expert opinion. And the board has been, as you know, and as I painfully know, very active in this process, examining every implementation aspect of it. They were involved to determine that the policy recommendations were, in fact, implementable. And then they checked along the way to determine that the implementation met the 19 policy recommendations as well as the principles and the guidelines that were published along with it. And so we see that the board very seriously has taken its responsibility for ultimate oversight of the program, and the board's going to continue to be very active in its oversight of the program once it's launched. But that doesn't mean that the board will revisit the findings of each of the panels and each of the dispute resolution providers, but instead make sure that those panels follow the rules established for them and the standards established for them through the that were created out of the policymaking process and the implementation of that. So I really, really, really don't see that those are mutually exclusive statements.
Well, then why is it that you say you want to do this in order to mitigate risk? I mean, the risk is they're going to be sued because they've made a decision. So, tie it together for me then. I mean, it says in the paper we need these to mitigate risk. So this really is about trying to remove responsibility. Because otherwise it wouldn't be mitigating risk.
So if you are correct, we'd be creating risk in this, because the board does have responsibility for the program. And the risk to the program is in creating a process or procedure that isn't transparent and predictable for applicants. So by what standard can a TLD be kicked out? It's got to be, here's the standards, here's the decision maker, and here's the process. So risk, and when I talk about risk, it's risk to do this process. So if this process attracts a lot of litigation, then I can publish the process and then did not follow it, or that the process wasn't clear so that the applicant had no way of predicting what was going to happen to its application. The risk is then litigation would halt the process and undermine the ICANN model. So it doesn't really have anything to do with the people that are the directors or the people that are the staff. It has to do with the credibility of ICANN as a model for internet governance and publishing a process. No, I'm not done yet. So for publishing a process and then following it. And what we're trying to do here is avoid risk to that process and the ICANN model for internet governance by clearly publishing a set of rules and clearly following them. And that includes providing appropriate expertise and the right level of expertise to each decision and providing competence in that way, and be able to predict outcomes and timetable in a way that we think is following the policy recommendations for the GNSO. So we're after the same thing. I still remain. I don't think those statements are mutually exclusive.
Anyone else like to get in the queue on issue 4? Okay. Anything else at all on issue 4? Any comments on issue 5, which basically I think we're all on the same page on? Okay. Let's talk about next steps. I'd like to think that there's been some improved understanding in terms of the intent of some of the recommendations, especially those that we talked about earlier in the call. Where do we go from here on this? Where do you go from here, Kurt, and your team?
Well, we're looking at each other. So clearly, we have some takeaways from this where we think there are some areas of change and agreement. And we also, one of our takeaways also is that, we have some different understanding of the report than when we read it. So I'm trying to... how we would set up the meeting in Cartagena, what our deliverable might be for the meeting in Cartagena to make it different, to take the issues we discussed today and, pick up where we left off. Because I think, I clearly understood what everybody said on the call. I hope, I was understandable in some way.
One of my concerns, Kurt, is that if our next step is after the staff does a little more work on their part, if our next interaction is in Cartagena, that's just a few days before the board will probably act on the final guidebook. So I'm having trouble understanding what the purpose of the meeting in Cartagena would be, other than maybe just understanding.
So, I guess, Chuck, this is Amy. Would would it be possible for you, for your group, for the working group, to clarify in writing? Certainly, because I could say, you know, obviously the board role issue is something that the report just did not say what we heard today. And I, and as Kurt said, it's always challenging to do this on the fly. So if you all could get together and at least clarify some of those some of that, that would probably be helpful for us, certainly.
Okay. Good. To facilitate that, could I ask you, you and Kurt, whoever you want on your team to do it, to just a brief, send us a send to the list a brief list of the areas that specifically need clarification. And then what I'd like to ask the working group members to do, I'd like to request several volunteers who would draft a first response to those, and then we can discuss it on the list. So let me first of all ask Kurt and Amy, is that okay to identify specifically where you heard different things than what you read in the recommendations? Is that okay?
Yes, that's definitely why I think we can put that together. I think Margie will be the probably the liaison with that. But
okay, point person, yeah.
Yeah.
That's good. That's good. Margie's given us great support on this working group, so we're happy with that. So, and then now, and I'd like to do this live, solicit some volunteers from the community working group, hopefully from different different groups, that would be willing to just be a interaction with yourself online, maybe a phone call or whatever. And I'm sure if assistance is needed there, that Isla and Glenn would help set up a phone call if that's needed. But could we get? I think all of us that are on this call know the issues. Who would like to volunteer from the community working group to help draft up a response that would be considered then by the broader working group? Okay, I see Aubrey, thank you. And Richard, do you have a comment, or are you volunteering?
Volunteering,
thank you. Okay, be nice to have do we have anybody from the ALAC that would volunteer?
You got to scroll down a bit to see my check mark there.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Thanks for reminding me of that. I will. I see John Nevitt, and I see Evan. Thank you, Evan. Anyone else want to volunteer on that? We have four people. That's actually not bad.
That's enough for a draft. Yeah.
For a draft, I would like to encourage that group of people. And Margie, if you would just send a reminder to the list of those four people. And Margie, you're willing to work with that group? Is that what I'm seeing there?
Yes. And also, when you have a chance, I want to talk a little bit about planning for Cartagena, because I do have to submit the final agenda today. So if you guys have thoughts on how that session should be what the agenda should look like, please let me know, and who should be panelists and that sort of information.
Okay. All right. So I think we've got that covered right now. So again, Margie, if you'd just send a message to the list that would say that these people have volunteered, and if somebody that wasn't on the call wants to volunteer, that's okay too. But I'm assuming that Margie, you'll get something out to the list in the next day or two with regard to the issues that need more definition, and then hopefully the four people who volunteered. And Cheryl, are you volunteering as well, or you wanted to say something?
I just wanted to make the point, which I was happy to wait till you finished with this wrapping up of this section, was, of course, this is running at the same time as the same volunteers, and indeed every one of us in the work group and the extended communities that we're involved with, are also trying to respond to more than just the changes in Module 3. There are public comments running on all of the applicant guidebook, and there is, you know, a recognition needed, I think, that this particular
regular cross-community work group is willing to do whatever it is able to, but we would like to know that we are not, how shall I say this, wasting our bloody time, quote unquote.
Thank you, Cheryl. Margie, would you go ahead on the agenda? Let's talk just a couple minutes about the agenda, and let me start off. Kurt, was there a particular agenda that you had in mind, or any of your team had in mind, with regard to the meeting in Cartagena on Recommendation 6?
Let's work on that over email. You know, we're way over time, and to tell you the truth, if somebody has a good idea, bring it up. I want to see what I think would be constructive, and I'd certainly be happy to hear what other people would think would be a good agenda too.
Okay, well, the deadline for agendas is today, but Margie, maybe you can just put a general statement that this will be a session to discuss the implementation, inclusion or lack of inclusion of the REC 6 Community Working Group recommendations in the guidebook. That probably will be sufficient for what we need today. Is that all right, Margie? Is that all right?
Yeah, that's.
And then go ahead and initiate a discussion on the list, and we can refine that agenda as we move forward and get closer.
Okay, thanks. I'll do that, Doug.
Thanks. Anything else before I adjourn the meeting?
Just for Margie's, I think, Avery's text of review resolution of issues 1 to 5, and then link the document that we've been discussing today may go a long way to a meaningful agenda.
Okay. And thanks, Robin, for your volunteering for that group as well. I appreciate that. All right. Well, thank you, everyone. It's been 2 hours and 15 minutes, it looks like, and appreciate, again, the ongoing good cooperation from all parties, and thanks, staff, for taking the time to do this with us, and let's see if we can't make it even better going forward. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you, Chuck.
Thank you, Chuck.